Okay, so I'll try to not keep us up all afternoon. So let me just get us back to speed by recalling two of the method items that we discussed. So we haven't seen much about evolutionary statistics, so here's two formulas that establish a connection to statistical mechanics that is quite far-reaching. So this is the, if you want, the statistical mechanics of evolutionary equilibrium, saying that essentially fitness multiplied by some noise strength, which is the effective population size in the simplest cases, acts as a Boltzmann factor. And that to some extent is all that there is to say all about equilibrium states. Competition between entropy and fitness and so is basically encoded in this formula. Yes.
Okay. I'm a cell biologist, so I understood the very first part of your talk that we skipped through just now, and I sort of understood when you started this part, and then I didn't follow.
So I try to sort of motivate the essential parts, and the main thing that I try to use this for is to say we can use this for inferring fitness. If we have from genomic analysis or phenotypic analysis some idea what this distribution of states is under selection and what this distribution of states is at neutrality, if we have furthermore a sufficiently simple parameter space that we can actually get histograms of these two distributions, we can just take the over-representation at a given value of x, and this is a proxy of fitness under the assumption of evolutionary equilibrium. And yes?
I just was wondering if that, at the amino acid level, this I think is just about exactly what Halpern and Bruno got.
Yeah, I mean, so of course I did not dwell here in the long history of different variants of this formula. At the single allele level, this is basically right. Then it was extended to whole sequence spaces and so on. So we can this formula has been derived in many different flavors over time.
So let me just introduce some alternative notation, because I think for other people, so X is actually, unless I'm mistaken, it should be the mean phenotype. And this is the distribution of possible mean phenotypes. Is that not correct?
So we're going to come to the phenotypic version of this in a moment, but you could think here of this X also as a genotype, if you want, or even as a genotype distribution if you have a polymorphic setup. So this coordinate can be chosen pretty much according to what is practical for that system. But it's always so that the distribution of things under selection is the ones under neutrality multiplied by a Boltzmann factor.
I mean, what you're just saying is X can be whatever. If you knew the neutral distribution, you know the how selection biases it, right?
I mean, I wouldn't go as far as to say whatever, because like it has to be things where we can work with in a given context. But I've shown you an example where X was a binding energy. It could be an allele frequency, and so it can be quite different things. That's indeed.
What is P0?
P0 is the distribution that we get under neutrality. So in this example that I propose not to go through in detail again, it was we had binding energies of a transcription factor to its cognate sites, and so there was, if we just took genomic tenmers in intergenic sequence, we could compute this E, and if we just take a sliding window and run it through all intergenic regions of yeast, we get of the order of 10 to the 5 counts of E. Most of them is where sites don't bind, so with respect to binding of ABF1, they are as good as neutral sites can be. Of course, they can be selected for lots of other things, and in general they will be, but with respect to this particular binding matrix and binding energy, they behave neutrally, and this is just shown here by the data. And then we have a subset of genomic sequence bits of length 10, which show a quite different distribution of this E. And then we would, if we wanted, under the assumption that they come from a common equilibrium ensemble, if we wanted to derive, to infer from these two distributions what the fitness is, then we would just take these two distributions, take their ratio, take the log, and would get something like this, which is proportional to fitness.
Can you just remind me from last time? The P naught is gotten, I assume, by just looking at all of this, basically across the whole genome.
Right.
Something. And these Qs are the specific sites that are known as the ABF1 binding sites.
Right. You can get this, for example, from an ensemble of known or biologically verified sites. You could also try, this is a little bit more subtle, but can be done, to decompose these mixture models into two distinct components without prior knowledge.
Is there circularity here in that, like, how are the ABF1 binding sites determined?
Well, you know, we would debate, if we were to now discuss this in detail, how to do it with the least amount of circularity. But, you know, I mean, people took various experimental techniques to get sort of ensembles of working binding sites.
Those are from ones that were identified.
Do you want to answer him first?
Yes. So this.
The guys in the actual histogram, those are sites that
yes.
yeast experimental people call
yes.
ABF.
Yes. Yes.
So there was a guy who came here 2 weeks ago, and maybe his theory is right, and maybe it's wrong. There was some discussion about that, but he was arguing that the. What you're saying, P0E was actually undergoing negative selection.
Right. I've seen actually the title of this talk. I haven't had the chance to hear it. There is potential that part of these sites are under slight negative selection. It's a subtle effect. I mean, I know that we have looked for this effect for a long time, and we couldn't really nail it down. So I was very interested to get Ido's take on it. However, whatever you think of signatures of negative selection, this is pretty much what you would expect just from random sequence, right? So if you would just take random 10 mers, fold them into this energy formula, you would get a distribution that's pretty similar to this. Okay, so the analogy to statistical mechanics goes a little bit further, and that leads us to what I want to talk about data today, and this is sort of the non-equilibrium counterpart to this formula. So in a nutshell, that's the non-equilibrium statistical mechanics of evolution, and it says that you have a quantity which is the amount of adaptive changes, the amount of fitness gained through changes. That's the same argument that figures in Fisher's theorem, that total amount, again multiplied by the same effective population size, is what distinguishes the actual process that has taken place from a hypothetical backward process that runs exactly through the same adaptive changes backwards. And clearly the bigger that number is, the more unlikely is it to just by chance or drift get that backward trajectory. And so in that sense, this measure here, and we're going to use it widely today, is an accumulative measure of the total thing in that has happened adaptively, say between two species. At the same time, it's a measure of the deviations from evolutionary equilibrium. Because equilibrium is distinguished by the fact that these two probabilities are the same. It's the same as if you run forwards and backwards. And this means that the average of this fitness flux has to be zero, what makes absolute sense, because you have just as many mutations that change allele A into allele B than you have backward mutations if you are at equilibrium. So, second short reminder about last time is that we tried to come up with a minimal model for macro that would be able to detect macroevolutionary adaptive evolution of a quantitative trait. So here is our null model. It's mere stabilizing selection. So if you wait for a long time in this null model, the trait mean would go back and would hop back and forth in this fitness landscape. It would be centered around here somewhere and around the peak, and then genetic drift might go push it around a little bit. But it's clearly, on the long term, is only it's only equilibrium. If you start somewhere down low, you would first move up and then move into this equilibrium state. So this is, in some sense, for the purposes of identifying adaptation, it's the null model. And Nick.
What is your argument or description of what's controlling that? I mean, you're thinking that the fitness is really centered around that mean and that it's bounded.
Right.
And so why do you think that?
Well,
why do you think it's plausible? What are scenarios under which?
Well, this is, let me come to a data example, and then we can discuss whether that's a plausible model for it. So for example, you can, this is if you want the minimal model of something that's under stabilizing selection, right? So something where a particular value of that trait is favored, and it's not so good if it's bigger, and it's not so good if it's worse. So in some sense, it's a generic model for stabilizing selection. You can argue whether, for example, gene expression levels, whether this is a reasonable starting point for an analysis, as I would argue. So if we want to make the minimal extension of this model that allows for adaptive behavior, in statistical physics term, breakdown of equilibrium, sustained adaptive behavior, that things keep changing just in the because maybe functionality changes, just as we heard in the talk this morning, then we would, we could say, well, let's now make this peak go itself undergo a movement. I take it here as a stochastic movement with a rate V that gives the diffusion of this peak in trait parameter space. Now, of course, the population has to follow this peak, right? So this is the green arrow. There is a component of directional selection superimposed to this stabilizing selection that the static fitness landscape might have. And of course, it's important, and we'll see this in the data, this is still a dynamical regime that is very far away from the rampant adaptive processes that, for example, are described by the traveling fitness waves, right? So here, it's a completely different dynamical regime. The short-term dynamics is always governed by stabilizing selection, and the stochasticity affects not just the tip of the wave, but the entire bulk. So that's a difference in the dynamical regime. And I guess, okay, so this is sort of the model.
People would call fluctuating selection.
Sorry?
People would call this fluctuating
selection. This you could call fluctuating selection. Now, the question is just on which time scales these fluctuations occur. So let me now come to an example of data.
It's going to persist in leading, whereas you envision that in this fluctuating selection, maybe things that were lagging edge under some other conditions will become leaders. Is that the notion?
This is one of the aspects. I mean, if you have the main...
At least anyone in the bulk, turn into a leader.
I wouldn't say anyone, but certainly not only the ones from from one edge. Because like if you just take the simple example of the static fitness landscape, where you have a quadratic fitness landscape, if you have this trait, it goes up and then it goes to some equilibrium state in the simplest case, where with small fluctuations around that around the maximum point, for example, generated by genetic drift, it could also be generated by genetic graph, but for example, generated by genetic drift. So the whole, the mean goes back and forwards over the peak. Everything is close to neutrality, in brackets, or to effective neutrality, but the whole bulk of this wave, of this population distribution, changes stochastically due to drift in this case. This is because it's in a quadratic fitness landscape and things in equilibrium get tuned to near neutrality. So in that sense, it's a little bit as far, it's, I think there are two main differences to standard traveling wave theories. And I'm not saying there isn't a bridge between the two, right? So the, maybe the big comprehensive theory is still lacking. I think the two differences are, first of all, the fitness landscape here is not linear, right? It has a maximum, right? So in as much as things are close to that maximum, selection strengths become weak. And secondly, the so the size of the typical size of selection coefficient and the epistasis that is in the fitness landscape. These are two features which are sort of not in these simple traveling wave models with a constant leading edge. But I mean, we can certainly discuss this further.
Am I understanding it correctly to say that you're sort of assuming that the rate at which the peak moves around is somehow slow compared to, so that the bulk of the population distribution is always kind of overlapping to some extent?
This with the peak, well, that again depends on the amount of mu and n. So it can be, there can be regimes where the mean square deviation, the mean, the variance of the mean population across population is dominant, and there can be a regime where the intra-population variance is dominant. In that case, for example, you would have a population distribution that somehow overlaps with a peak, maybe in a slightly asymmetric way, but both ends of the population would be disfavored by fitness, and the fittest ones would be somewhere in the middle. That's also a regime that exists. So there's certainly there's different regimes, and it's in its details quite subtle. But let's move to a concrete data example. I think maybe now it's time to talk about some data. Maybe some of the things we can retake. So here is like what we did with this model. We wanted to settle the question, how much of gene expression divergence is adaptive? And this, again, over the last roughly 10 years since expression microarray data came about, this was an active discussion in the population, and sometimes still not settled. For essentially, so a simple reason, that is the one that we also discussed this morning. It's very hard to distinguish if you just take the primary data, relaxed selection from directional selection. So you see a change in some expression level. Is it just because the peak got wider? That gene hasn't been so important anymore. So before, its expression value was nailed down to a narrow region around that peak. Now that peak got flatter and it's around to move. Or is it because the peak position has changed and there has been directional selection pushing that value towards the new peak? So in a nutshell, that's the difficulty of inference. You see movement of the trait coordinate, but the reason behind it, there are these two possibilities. Now, in sequence analysis, we have a way around this because we have neutral sequence to compare things with, and these classical tests like the McDonald-Kreitman test use a comparison with neutral sequence to distinguish the positive selection scenario from a relaxation of constraint. But here, we don't have that benefit, and we have to come up with a new method. Yes, Nick.
I was wondering, this is an analogy you always see in proteins, is that there's also the possibility that for whatever reason, the beak moves and the interactions are modified so that it becomes happier with the expression, if I can use that anthropomorphic term, with the expression level that happens to exist. So when you have an expression level change, that the other interactions will adjust to that, which when then appear as though it was adapted. And that was an adapted right. level of expression right. without actually right. being what we would, I think, normally call adapted.
Right. Now here, I think this is a good point, because what we mean by adaptation depends to some extent on the size of the system that we look at, especially if you have interacting system, something that can be primary adaptive changes, and then other things that just get happier with as follow-ups. Now here, sort of, this analysis is still at the sort of single gene level. No attempt is at this point made to disentangle this, for example, into pathways and so on. But let's see where we get with this. So this is the data of about six expression data of about 6,000 genes that were unique homologous genes were unique orthologous genes were found in seven species of Drosophila, and if you now plot for these genes just in an aggregate way, the divergence over time normalized by the intra-species diversity. That was the measure which I proposed on Tuesday. You get the following pattern, which indeed is, so if we just look at it, it's quite, it's relatively clean. The noise deviations are kind of under control. And it's, when we just look at this pattern, how the divergence suitably normalized, but the overall pattern, of course, doesn't matter how we normalize it, how it changes, it's clearly not neutral evolution, right? If we had something that neutrally accumulated, we would get a straight line, but it would start from zero, right? So the divergence would be increasing linearly with time. You could also say,
what's the scale?
Well, this is here, this scale, this is pure numbers, right? So, okay, the neutral expectation I've here, in order to not get a diagram that is too high, I've switched the axis here, below, above 0.2, right? So here it's 1.0, this is just squeezed a little bit on top. That's why you see here this discontinuity in slope. Right, so ignore this gray line for the moment. Here is a linear scale, and here it's just this upper part is squeezed a little bit.
But is divergence, is this on the scale of the square difference?
That's this is at the level of the square difference, yes. And here you see, like, so we start from male, actually we aggregate data in clades. This is, I should maybe for completeness mention this, so we have here, so there is male sim is the closest pair. Then we aggregate data for this phylogenetic distance between these three species. The next clade is this guy. The next clade is this. Then we have the whole one, and we have one clade over here. So you see these again here on the next slide. So this is male sim, male yak, and here is the overall aggregated divergence over this entire Drosophila genus. And so it is linearly increasing with divergence time. But you see that there's very, so if you wanted to now think, oh, well, is it just under stabilizing selection? Then with the, you would need a thing that saturates very quickly, because this is like an absolute number here. We can infer the stabilizing strength that this is happening under, and any static model would lead to a rapid saturation roughly on the time scales of the order of the male sim divergence time. So this this pattern is clearly not compatible with a simple linear increase. It's also not compatible with a stabilizing selection leading to a saturation.
So are you looking at the divergence in gene expression?
Yes.
So this is looking at all genes?
This is now here, it is aggregated over genes. I will show this for different gene classes in a moment. So here it's like, this is just the simplest thing you can do. Of course, there is some bioinformatics involved in it, in suitably normalizing things, taking off additive shifts between species. There's some technology of which, in the interest of time, I maybe shouldn't go into, but I'm happy to discuss it.
You would expect that some genes should indeed be on the stabilizing selection.
Some are, yes.
They sit on
And the point is, and I'll come back to, let me come back to this on the next slide. So
I raise another, I mean, so the whole issue here is the non-zero intercept. I would be concerned that the expectation isn't zero, simply because if you take one species of fly and another, grow them in, even if they're the same clone, they're gonna be different in terms of gene expression just by chance. So there really should be a non-zero intercept. It may be way below that. I don't know, but I can't imagine it could truly be zero.
Well, I mean, we tried quite carefully to get the divergence separated from the isogenic variance that you would get from the noise in the sample, and also
from the
genetic variance.
These flies are, they're sort of from different environments.
Right.
You know, if this was all melanogaster still using the same natural world as melanogaster, I guess I'd feel a little more comfortable. But if there's genotype environment interaction, I'm just concerned that the true intercept really can't be zero. I don't know. Right? Even experimental error gives you a non-zero intercept.
Right. But that be discounted from this divergence here. So we discounted the genetic variance and the isogenic variance as best that they could be established from this data set. I'm not saying there are not subtleties in the data evaluation, but what we try to plot here is really something that should start from zero. But we can discuss in how far this is possible from these data, or there might be additional confounding factors.
Let's say if we just compare within one species, but if you could compare a gene expression patterns in two kinds of cells, you would have all this kind of divergence, but you wouldn't have divergence
right.
time in that case. Right? And for different species, the cellular composition could be completely different between species. So how would you compensate that difference on your plot?
I mean, that's true. That's a possible confounding factor. Now here, these are aggregate data, right? So they're not cell type specific data. And you will see, I'll show you in a moment, so what makes us at least trust that this is an evolutionary signal is that we see differences between different classes of genes. So that this also applies to Boris' question, and we come to this in a moment. So
So I got lost from the slide before that to this. So can you say in a simple word, what do you mean by gene expression divergence?
So by gene expression divergence, I mean after suitable sort of adjustment of averages of all genes between two species, we take the mean population expression value in one species, the mean population expression value in the other species. Here, first gene by gene, but now it's an average, it's aggregated over these genes. I'll show you less aggregated data. And but it is consistent with a model that has two molecular clocks, right? So one fast change here and the other here. And the argument, we can try to use this to infer the amount of adaptation. In the seedscape model, this would be the amount of divergence that you would get from a static fitness peak. It would have a certain saturation amplitude and then saturate, and we can compute sort of the strength from the saturation time. That's the saturation time and the saturation amplitude are related. And the ongoing change beyond that, which is here shown in green, would be the amount that is to be ascribed to adaptive behavior. Now, one thing, I'll come to this in a moment, one thing that let me just say about this thing is what we already discussed last time. There is a fundamental difference in quantitative trait evolution to sequence evolution in the sense that it doesn't make sense to say, oh, so and so much of gene expression divergence is adaptive. The statement makes only sense if you relate it to a given divergence time, because on short time scales, the evolution is always dominated by this quasi-neutral behavior that is moving around in a given fitness peak. Only after waiting for a little while, you can see this ongoing change of the peak. That's a key difference to sequence analysis. That's why if we take, for example, male sim, that fraction is small. If we take the whole genus, that fraction is the majority. Nick.
I'm just concerned. Historically, there's been a lot of really stupid arguments about adaptation and neutrality. And what you're presenting, and I see that as a very adaptationist argument. And that what the data are really saying is that there are perhaps two processes
right.
going on. And you're choosing to view the second process as adaptation. I just think that maybe even just historically, it might be good to be a little more accommodating of the idea that it might not be what we normally think of as adaptation, or there might be other explanations.
There might be. That's why the text says here, consistent with evolution in the single peak fitness seascape. Well, all I'm saying at the moment is, all I'm saying at the moment is, if you take this class of models which I presented and take this as a sort of guiding scheme of models that offer the potential of both stabilizing selection and directional selection in a coherent model framework. If I now just ask within this class of model, then this pattern is not consistent with a peak that stays, because that would need to lead to saturation pretty quickly. And we can calculate the time and the amplitude, and this would be this blue line. Secondly, it's not consistent with no peak at all, because that would lead to something that is ongoing, that's a linear pattern. It is, however, consistent in a quite quantitative way with a moving fitness peak with a given rate, and with a given movement rate. And of course, this is a typical inference argument. This is within that class of models. It's this choice. I'll show you on the next slide alternative scenarios. We tried very hard to be critical, and I'll show you a list of other scenarios that we tried to examine, and one by one discarded. Boris.
Do you mind going back for just one more second? So again. Naively, am I okay to think that now this stabilizing, like this sort of characteristic heightened case of stabilizing, so you can measure divergence characteristic of drosophila population, right? And there is some characteristic width in gene expression patterns, right? And presumably some of it is technical variance and some of it is biological variance, so hopefully not all the biological variance is technical. And so hopefully it agrees with that position of the line, is it? And
well,
similarly, one can draw kind of similar, like within species error bars, biological variation around every point, right?
Right. And that they're listed here, and that's like kind of I didn't talk about this plot. So this is like the pattern that you get from isogenic variance between isogenic copies.
So are they consistent with the number on the slide?
What I'm saying is these variations are smaller, and then there's the typical range of divergences. Of course, so we are not, so that there are these samples in different species. We're not told what is divergence. This also comes back to Mike's question.
For example, at least enough of them have been microarrayed.
Yeah, so this is sort of, I mean, in this data set, there's a sort of a typical scale of divergences, and it increases as it should with phylogenetic distance. And so it looks, and then there's all these technical errors between isogenic individuals and so on that we try to subtract to get to the divergence. Of course, one can debate all these steps, like how.
So I think Scott Ripken did some work several years ago on mutation accumulation lines, I think, on gene expression implies. And that shows you direct, I think that would be a direct estimate of the neutral expectation, right? So he started with isogenic lines and then just put them through long, I don't remember, you know, maybe 100 generations. And measure gene expression at the end. And they were full sig mated, so they're bottlenecked. So I think that those data, I mean, it was a few years ago, I don't think they're good enough, but they would provide an empirical basis for the neutral expectation. That would tell you what the slope
is. Yeah, and indeed, sort of the, when we, In this model, we can calculate the neutral expectation. It's way below that. But that's a good suggestion. We could maybe take Scott Rifkin's data and see how much they would fall on the gray line. So here is from this aggregate analysis, you get this kind of estimates. And so on the scale of the whole Drosophila species, this is the majority. Now, of course, you can ask, can't we do this for individual genes? This would be a sort of much more detailed analysis. But of course, for a given gene, we have, after averaging over isogenic individuals and so on, we have 7 data points. So this is hopeless. You can fit anything of these curves through that 7 data points, and there's no statistical evidence. Now, that's why, but however, one can make a probabilistic analysis, a likelihood analysis, and then aggregate data over classes of genes. So in this gene-specific analysis, so you only get a posterior distribution of values, say, for the strength of selection and for the amount of adaptation phi. But remembering what we said, that this is a dimensionless measure of how much adaptation there is. So if it's larger than 1, the process is adaptive in the sense that it's unlikely that it's due just to genetic drift. So this is it's a pure number that says how much adaptation there is. And so we chose a relatively stringent threshold of 4, meaning that the reverse process is e to the 4 times less likely than the forward process. And again, a similar number, a similar percentage of these genes are in that sense significantly adaptive. So this is here the histogram of fitness flux that you get from this probabilistic analysis gene by gene. So and maybe this addresses a little bit the question whether this is just a technical or, you know, or gene differences in gene class composition between species. We find a number of things that make sense. So genes with specific codon usage and genes with high expression level, these two classes are anyway known to be correlated with one another, show significantly less adaptation on this gene expression level.
So what is specific codon usage?
Well, specific codon usage means high codon bias, codon usage bias compared to low codon usage bias. More adaptation in genes with broad codon usage, genes with specific functions. So when we now fish for functional classes that are enriched in genes with high fitness flux, then, well, you know, you get things that you can sort of make sense of as adaptive classes for gene expression. And finally, genes with male-biased expression. So when we take those subclass of genes where the male expression is significantly higher across all species than the female expression, show also significantly higher values of this fitness flux. And that, incidentally, is in tune with what the original publication of these data found at the sequence level. Right? So there's also there was a finding that male-biased genes are also distinguished at the sequence level of expression. We find this at the sequence evolution level, and we find the same statement at the level of expression. Now, is this the only scenario that is compatible with these data? So this is like now the question. And of course, this the fact that there's several scenarios has kept the debate in that on that pretty much alive over the last 10 years. So what other scenarios did we look at and try to see, well, is that a possible explanation of this pattern? So one thing we looked at is lineage-specific demography. So you could think of that just maybe consistently over large evolutionary times, maybe population sizes were smaller along one lineage. Of course, things like that are known. In Drosophila, there were bottlenecks, for example, that people have inferred in the more recent history. But of course, this history goes down 60 million years. So if we were to have stabilizing selection with sort of just along these different lineages of our tree, and just go back for a moment to the tree, say, suppose we would have a lesser population size on this particular branch, explaining relaxation, global relaxation of selection, right? It's just less, the peak is shallower on that side. But there's no adaptive changes. The optimum of the peak would still be at the same position. This would be another plausible thing to say, well, that could explain the movement that goes on in one lineage and sort of in these. But we would see then, and I unfortunately didn't print here the plot for that, we would see then relaxation, but on that particular lineage, on that particular branch, the stabilizing, the saturation value should be higher. We could not detect between these different lineages differences in the pattern, neither in the offset nor in the slope. So the next scenario that we looked at, and we can all think whether there are other scenarios that we should, furthermore, should look at, but this is the ones that we came up with, or basically that's also the ones that sort of things are discussed in the literature. You could think, well, what about if it's not a global relaxation of population size, but there is just stochastic loss and gain of genes, right? So a single gene might lose functionality and then become essentially neutral for that single gene. That might make a move in this expression level. And it could also, if you think that the rate of gene loss is proportional to time, it could make the second slope linear with time. And it would just mean, again, relaxation of constraint with the amount of relaxation increasing with time. So this would be another scenario. This was an scenario that kept us actually working for a little bit, because at the level of the divergence, this would make exactly the same pattern. The secondary linear slope would just be the ongoing relaxation. Here and there, with a certain rate, genes become dysfunctional or maybe less functional, and their gene expression would then allow to be varying more. And if we use aggregate data, and in order to suppress noise, we have to use some kind of aggregation, we would see an ongoing slope. But it would have nothing to do with adaptation. So in order to come around this, we looked at, actually this is a similar argument that has been used in a slightly different context by Hunter Fraser in this analysis. We used the argument that most genes are actually upregulated by selection, right? So If you relax selection, it wouldn't randomly change, but they would just be expressed less. So if that loss of function was an appreciable mode, we should see the large movement preferentially on the side of the distribution towards lower expression. So we, from this symmetry breaking, there would be a way of detecting that, even though we couldn't detect it at the just by plotting the divergence over time. We did not find in the full distribution of changes. So this is something that works on higher moments than just the second moment. The divergence is just the mean square deviation, but you can look at the actual distribution of that differences and can try to see whether you find larger values in the tail of negative changes. So this we didn't find. So we concluded that this was this of course we can't exclude that this happens for some genes, and of course genes are known to be lost, and there are other genes are gained by, for example, gene duplication or something like that. They would be underrepresented in our data set, these gained genes, because they wouldn't be unique orthologous genes in all six species. But as best as we could, we tried to see whether there is a signature for this loss, because this we would see just as before this gene becomes a pseudogene. If it's just relaxed, we would just see still expression, but at a lower level, and we didn't see any such asymmetry. Finally, you could say, what is there special about this model with small ongoing diffusive changes along each lineage? Couldn't you say, well, we make big changes, but rarer big changes? This would be a more punctuated model of evolution at the expression level, or a more intermittent model, if you will, in the language of physics. You could say, well, here is my stabilizing, my peak. This thing is not making much movement. And then suddenly something that happens that wants this gene to have another expression, and this is a big change, but a rarer change. So for example, you could think that these changes happen, for example, for some genes on given lineages. Major ecological changes. Of course, this is also something that will happen for some genes, and we can't exclude it. We don't see it as a dominant mode. This is also a dangerous mode, if you will, because if you think for a moment, would also make exactly the same pattern of divergence. Now, suppose every gene that undergoes this functional change requiring a big expression change makes an expression change of order one in some suitable units. Then, of course, at the level of that single gene, you would see it. If you plot now the expression pattern of 500 genes on top of each other, you would again see a slope, not because the changes for a single gene increase gradually, but just because the number of affected genes increases linearly with time. You would again get such an ongoing linear change. How could we discriminate these two modes? Not at the level of the divergence. Again, we can look at the whole distribution of expression changes, which has more than the second moment, and these two modes would be distinguished in the higher moments of this expression change distribution. And to cut the discussion, to finish it, we didn't find evidence for a higher moments of this change being compatible with this one. So this is certainly going to happen for some genes, but we don't find evidence for this against the diffusive scenario. Of course, this is, in some sense, is not so much a dangerous point for our argument, because these would be two different modes of adaptation, right? If the peak either changes gradually and the thing has to be adjusting as things go along, or if at some point the peak changes a lot and then the thing has to follow, both are versions of directional selection. Yes?
The data was acquired, because that may be influencing what you see. So first, these different Drosophila species. This is data from species that have been adapted with blood. Is that correct? They've been adapted for some period of time in a lab environment, or were these from wild populations?
I think these were from wild populations, but I have to double check the precise. I think people were quite careful to make also these things, the arrays comparable between species and so on. So there's certainly a lot of issues at the data level.
Because
and
that's where you might get some sort of punctuated equilibrium, right?
We might. I mean, we didn't find any sort of signature of punctuated events, but of course there will be for some genes, but nothing very, you know, nothing genome wide certainly, because that we would see also in our aggregate patterns.
And then the other question is how is the expression data acquired? Is it one lab that acquired it from a bunch of different, or are we comparing across labs? Because that actually might scare me a lot if we're comparing expression data across labs.
I think this was one lab that acquired the data. I'm not exactly sure, but certainly one lab that tried to make things as comparable as possible. And that's why this data set is a few years old. It's still the best one for this comparability that we could find. But it's certainly something that could be all sorts of things of that sort in the primary data. Incidentally, sort of a pattern of this, it would be quite interesting to compare this with what you told us this morning, because it's in essence, if I understood your argument correctly, a similar thing, right? So that
yes.
we have here also, here it's a comparison across different divergence times, and you were also making an argument on the relative changes across different divergence times. So that's maybe something we could discuss. And all right, so here is the conclusions of part two. So if you believe this argument, then not only at the sequence level, where people have found lots of signatures of positive selection, but also at this expression level, if we look on the entire scale of the Drosophila genus, this is the majority, it accounts for the majority of the gene expression divergence found. However, it's a different sort of statement in the sense if you ask the same question between Malagonaster and Simulans, it would not. Genetic drift or stochastic changes would be primary factor in the divergence. So this adaptive pattern, unlike for sequences, has these two molecular clocks. That's the signature of this quantitative trait evolution, if it's adaptive. And so one can, this is maybe one way how one can think of if we evolve methods that they can be used to look at high throughput data of similar sort.